Well, welcome to you and good day. It's Disciplined Investor Time. Andrew Horowitz, your host. It is episode number 60 of The Disciplined Investor, and thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a rough week, and I apologize for that, although I had nothing to do with it. I thought what we'd do is bring you some more, hopefully some more reality. I have a wonderful guest that we had an amazing discussion with. His name is Michael Shedlock. For his friends, he's called Mish, and he is a top blogger. He is an economist, a money manager, and most importantly, he has an incredible knack for cutting through the BS when it comes to economics, economic reports, and really finding out what is the inside meaning of most of this. Also being quite, well, let's say, quite an efficient seer of the future when it comes to the economy. I followed his work for some time. We'll give you some links to his blog and his information in the show notes on the episode number 60, over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and there's some other goodies over there too. So without any further ado, I'm going to have a short beginning, and then what we will do is come back, give you some things to ponder, and then get right into our interview with Michael Shedlock. Hang on. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
And here we are, and welcome again to episode number 60. I thought before we began this discussion, I'll tell you a couple of things. First of all, thank you so much for joining me and all the great notes of email you've sent me and the comments on the website. I appreciate that very much. Thank you so much for downloading and making us so popular. That's really really wonderful, and hopefully you're gaining something out of this. Now, for the people who are aggravated with me, pissed off at me because I've been rather negative on the markets and really kind of, I've been really just, it's been ugly. Let's just put it that way. I have not let off with my negative attitude. Maybe we've lost some listeners and all that. Frankly, that's not the point. The point here is twofold. Number one, to learn from some great people we bring on as guests. Number two is to understand how to protect our money and how to make sure that we are really being smart. We're being disciplined. Disciplined investors, of course, as the name of the show implies. But what I thought we would start today is to, it is now, I'll tell you where we exactly are now and tell you a little bit of background, okay? It is now Saturday morning. I am reading the Investor's Business Daily. I'm on page 82 of the Monday, June 9th, 2008 edition. If you're a subscriber to Investor's Business Daily, you get a few days earlier, you get the money edition on Saturday morning. And I always find it's a great way to really figure out what's gone on for the week before and looking forward to the week ahead. Now, mind you, the discussion I had with Mike Shedlock happened a day and a half ago. Okay, we talked on Thursday night at length. So when you think about that conversation, I want you to realize usually we're a little bit tighter, but this time we arranged it this way. And I'm telling you that we did a little bit early because obviously much of the conversation was a pretense for what was going to happen. Now, we didn't cause it, of course, but you know, we did release it a little bit later, so I want you to keep that in mind. I'll remind you of that in a moment. But what I wanted to do first was, I didn't want to make this like C-SPAN, but I wanted to read you the right-hand side of page 82, okay? And I want you to listen to what's going on, and then I have a follow-up to this. I'm just going to read you just the basics. Ready? So here we go. In finance, Lehman may report results early. What's going on there? I said to myself. Lehman Brothers, all of a sudden, with all the struggling investment, you know, this struggling investment bank is going to potentially release early. I am thinking the reason they're doing that is they want to kill two birds with one stone. They want to release numbers, and they want to go as fast as they can to get more money. They need money to survive. They're going to have an offering of some type, probably not preferred stock this time. If you read my commentary on Smokescreen, Lehman offering preferred stocks, you'll see that I thought that was a bunch of crap back then. And to be honest with you, I am not stupid enough to put my money into Lehman Brothers or any of the financials right now. It's kind of like standing on the side of a fire and taking dollar bills and just tossing them in. Next up, S&P sees downgrade risks rising. S&P finally came to the front last week or so and downgraded a few of the financials. Now they're going to all of a sudden downgrade a variety of other people. Hello? Knock, knock. Anyone home? I mean, come on, guys. Aren't we a little bit late by this already? I mean, what happened to the fact that we're supposed to be looking out for the benefit and the well-being of our pocketbooks? I mean, what is going on? They are so late to this charge. I wonder if it's kind of a contrary indicator. I don't really think so. Next up, National City agrees to oversight. The nation's 10th largest bank, which has been hard hit by mortgage-related losses, agreed to tighter federal oversight. Uh-oh. There was a private memorandum, and really kind of in the background, memorandum of understanding with the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, effectively putting the bank on probation. Uh-oh. AIG said that the SEC and Justice Department were investigating whether it's overstated the value of contracts linked to subprime mortgages. That's just a start, folks. The economy, wholesales, inventories jump 1.3%. The ECRI's leading index indicators fall again. Consumer credit rose by $9 billion. U.S. machine tool demand fell. German output fell. Bush is mulling a new stimulus measure. I mean, oh, how about the fact that unemployment is now at 5.5%? Hourly earnings are down. Manufacturing construction monthly change in jobs is down dramatically. And the service industry is all but kaput. But you know what? People are upset that we're talking negative issues. Let's not look at it that way, okay? Let's not be thinking, oh, he's positive, oh, he's negative. Let's look at it as the information that we need to input in our models to make it so that our portfolios are operating correctly. Now, if you've been listening to me, hopefully, what you've found is that by being so negative, we have a ginormous amount of money in cash right now. And it's been adding slowly but surely. We picked up about 5 or 6 positions over the last few weeks for our clients, and we immediately pulled it. For example, there was a position that we put on at $66, a position called Greif Inc., G-R-E-I-F Inc. G-E-F is the symbol. And earnings came out, hit about 73 the next day. We pulled out. We got out actually on average about 71. It quickly went down to about 69 or 68. In addition to that, any of the positions that we've been adding, we've been very, very careful to make sure to have sell stops, downside protection, and make sure that we know where we're going to limit this whole risk. Are you doing that? If you don't know how to do that, if you don't understand how to do that, don't buy the stock in the first place. Are you hedging your portfolio? I've talked about this. As a matter of fact, with this episode, I'm going to put on the site a link to how you can actually hedge your portfolio. I'm going to put a list of ETFs that are short ETFs in which way that you can hedge your portfolio. But here's the point. If, in fact, you are kind of bewildered investing without really full knowledge of what you're doing, this is not amateur hour out there. Now, I'm not accusing you of that, but I'm telling you, it is not for the weak of heart. It's not for if you don't know what you're doing, you should not be investing right now. That's the fact, okay? All of this information that we have in front of us, the funniest part of it all, everything that I just read to you, I want to read you one more thing. This is now still in Investor's Business Daily, page B17. This is a discussion that says, traders seek safe haven of treasuries after weak jobs report rattles stocks. Now, mind you, they don't talk about the oil a lot here, but oil obviously is an all-time high right now. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's just ridiculous, 11% just on Friday. But here's what really caught my eye. It says, the job report caught bond and stock traders by surprise, said David Dietz, chief investment strategist at Point View Financial Services. It raises new concerns about where this economy is going, and that we may end up in a recession, resulting in a massive sell-off of stocks and buying in that traditional safe standby treasury bonds. Surprise? What is a surprise here? There's no surprise here. There's absolutely no surprise here. We were just faking ourselves out, trying to believe that everything was fine. And a matter of fact, this discussion we have with Mike Shedlock is going to shed some light on exactly what that means. I think most of these markets have been full of baloney. I think that people have been bidding them up without real understanding of the underlying principles that are so terrible. And I'll tell you something else. It's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. Now, with that in mind, you know that there are ways to make money here. And I think that what we're going to do is make sure that you understand, if it's the last thing I do, that by being a disciplined investor, you can make money in all of these market conditions. With that, let me just say one more thing and we'll end it here. Or two more things, actually. Number one, if you, in fact, want to have us manage money, we finally named the fund. It's called the Disciplined Investors Managed Growth Fund. That's a hopeful little ring there. We have a great response to the indication of interest. If you are looking to invest at least $50,000 with us on an active portfolio where we're going to go long and short and do the options, all the things we talk about here in this podcast. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you know this, but we did a survey and a study, and it found that every single position that we had recommended on our website, on the disciplinedinvestor.com, if you would have followed us exactly, bought when we told you to buy, sold when we told you to sell, and hold the rest till now, 1.5 years later, you're up 14.79% as compared to only up 2% with the S&P 500 in that same period of time. Huge differential. So if you're looking to invest, of course, nothing is guaranteed. Go to the show notes, click indication of interest. We're going to hold it open for about 2 more weeks. We have just a great, great response from it. And we will do something that you've never seen before in terms of the access. We're going to have ongoing personal commentary, audio commentary delivered just to the clients, 100% automated and technology-driven portfolio, which I think you're going to really like. We have some really neat things from the administration side and for you to keep in total contact and, in fact, learn as we're going, because you can actually learn what we're doing as we're investing. So with that, we'll keep that there. And then I'm going to give you, at the end of the show, a chance to get a free book. So stick around. We're going to be right back with Michael Shedlock. Mish, just a great guy, a great economist, can tell us all about who he is and all about what's going on with the market. So hang on. We'll be right back.
This is Brian Jackman from CNBC, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
And welcome back to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for being here. Remember to stick around after the interview. I'm going to give you an opportunity to win a free book, The Disciplined Investor. I'll give you all the details when we get back right after the interview with Michael Shedlock. Mish, hey, one thing I want to mention before we get to this interview, that, of course, it's important to remember, stick in the back of your mind, we did talk about this on Thursday evening, 1 day before the market corrected, 1 day before the jobs number came out, and 1 day before the oil spiked about 10%. So keep that in mind. We get into that with Michael Shedlock, who is investment advisor with Sitka Pacific Capital Management. All right, as I told you, we're going to get into some really good economics today. We're with one of my favorite people. His blog is probably the best when it comes to economics. He's a brilliant writer, a good money manager, great money manager, and he's with Sitka Pacific Capital Management. My name is Mike Shedlock, but we're going to call him Mish. Mish, how are you?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be on the show. I was looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I want to talk to you, and I really want to dig deep because, you know, you and I talked a couple of weeks ago for the first time, but I've read your work before, and we really had a lot of things in common. I want to know what you think is going on with the economy, and let's break it down. Let's start with the idea of homes and home sales, new home sales. The numbers came out recently that we saw a lot of interesting statistics. Tell us a little bit about those, and we'll dig into those.
The flow of funds came out from the Fed. That's a report, and it shows that household real estate assets decreased from $20 trillion to $19.7 trillion. And that sounds like a lot of money. It's certainly $20 trillion, that's a lot of money. It's a decline of $328 billion. When you factor in home improvements, it's actually a decline of $431 billion, almost half a trillion dollars. That's a lot. The interesting fact to me in the report was that household percent equity is an all-time low, 46%. It goes back all the way to 1952 from when they first started piling stats on this. Yet, on the other hand, 31% of households have no mortgage. So a lot of people don't have 100% equity.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, in spite of that 100% equity, by a pretty substantial portion, 31%, the household equity is 46.2%.
Mm.
So that is why we're seeing walking away. That's why we're seeing all of these foreclosures. People no longer have a stake in their houses. They're underwater on those houses. And they've given up trying to support those houses.
So what we're saying is, you know, you say they don't have any stake. No skin in the game here. People are walking away. So you're saying that they don't figure in. This is interesting because when we see the statistics and we're all, you know, happy on a weekly or monthly basis that, oh, look at that, new house sales are up here or there. What you're saying, though, is that essentially those figures are questionable because even though we have a contract, a new house sale, they may not go fully to contract and fully closing. So therefore, a lot of the contracts are really, you know, the numbers, the statistics are bogus?
I wouldn't say bogus isn't the right word. It's just the way that they're formulated. The new home sales are recorded the minute someone signs a contract. What's been happening is we've had huge cancellations. We've had cancellation rates as high as 44%, even higher, at Toll Brothers, Lennar, some of the other big home builders. Those cancellations are not subtracted out of new home sales. So for months, actually years on end now, we've seen new home sales reported, and that's why these numbers every month are revised lower. The cancellations come in, the numbers are backward revised. It's unless one factors in those new home cancellations into those new home sales, we are talking about sales that don't really exist.
Well, you know what? Most people, I think, look at the economics and the statistics in a way. They say, okay, things are looking either good or bad. They don't get down to the nitty-gritty and really understand, because they're not easy to understand, a lot of these. I mean, you say even if we do get good numbers, we have revisions. I have a theory on revisions, but let me first tell you my theory on statistics. And that is, when I was in, I think I was in seventh grade, I had a math teacher. His name was Jake Eckstein. And he used to say to me all the time, figures never lie, but liars always figure. And unfortunately, it was talking to me, I think, at the time. But nonetheless, you know, statistics and the way that things are reported, you know, I always question when I hear the numbers, are we going to, you know, especially governmental statistics, you know, hey, what's the revision going to be? And can they be putting out numbers that maybe aren't bogus but are somewhat not exact and say, you know what, don't worry about it. We'll hide it under in the revision. I mean, is that something that goes on?
Oh, absolutely that goes on. I don't believe the CPI numbers. I don't know anyone that does consumer price index. I don't know anyone that believes that. Now, my position is that we can talk about this at a later time, but my position is that inflation is not a measure of pricing of rising prices, but a measure of expanding credit and money. But the standard definition looks at prices. And when the government comes out and says that when it's figuring the gross domestic product, when it's figuring the GDP, and they come out and they say prices went up 1% or 2.4%, which is the latest set of numbers that we've actually seen when they figured the gross domestic product, those numbers aren't believable.
I feel really good now.
You feel really good about
that? Yeah,
feeling
really good. Yeah, that all these numbers that we base on all our happiness on when it comes to, you know, whether or not the economy is doing well are questionable. I mean, I think we all knew that, but I mean, to what degree do we trust any of it?
Well, there are some numbers you can believe. The weekly jobs numbers that come out where they report claims, those are pretty much, I believe, unmanipulated. However, by the time the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, manipulates that data for their monthly data, they factor in jobs that they imagine. And there's no other way to describe it other than their imaginary jobs. They look at the state of the economy, and they say, oh, the economy is expanding. So we don't know about these businesses. So they assume a certain set of jobs are being created. And the interesting factor is they're adding jobs to categories of construction and finance. Now, we know without a doubt that just looking at homes and commercial real estate, that construction jobs have been falling through the floor. Yet every month there's a positive bias from the government saying that construction jobs were created. It makes the entire monthly jobs report. We've got it coming out tomorrow. I'll talk about it on my blog. Every month I look at the jobs report, and month in, month out, I'm liable to say another jobs report from Pluto, because they're talking about construction and finance jobs that are non-existent. They're adding to those jobs at a time when we've got a lot of independent mortgage brokers. We've got real estate agents that haven't sold a home in 6, 7, 8, 9 months. Technically, they're still employed, but they don't have any income. So, none of that's factored into the jobs report.
All right, so now I'm a little bit... I got to take a breath here, because you're telling me that the government and the BLS, of Bureau of Labor Statistics, and a few of the other powers that be are putting out massaged numbers that are going to... What's the purpose?
I mean, it's based on their model. Well, the purpose would be, right now I think there's a deliberate bias to heading into the election to not say that we're in a recession. And that's the big factor that's going on right now. They've actually changed their methodology within the last couple of months to, especially when it comes to consumer prices, that claims that they're not going up as much as they are. They have what they call seasonal adjustments. So we very seldom see the raw numbers being reported on when these reports come out. All these numbers are seasonally adjusted. Now they've changed the way in which they've seasonally adjusted these numbers. So when we go to the gasoline pump and we see that gasoline right now in my area in Chicago, it's $4.19 a gallon. And when a couple months ago it was $3.56, which we thought was high, but now it's $4.19, and the government comes out and says, well, seasonally adjusted, prices are only up 1%. And you look at that, and you're scratching your head because you look at the price on the pump, and they're up 20%.
Right, right, exactly.
So the numbers are not believable. No one believes the numbers.
Well, I mean, but you say no one believes the numbers, but when you see a good jobs number come out, the markets react accordingly. When you see a CPI number come out, and by the way, I have a question. You and I knocked heads in a good way. We were talking about this last week. I don't understand the whole platform of saying, or the idea of saying, we have no inflation ex energy and ex, what was it, food costs, a couple of weeks back, right? Remember that? They came out with a statement, and I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. So
how did they do that? They revised their method for seasonal adjustments heading in to an election, which we've got a president and an administration that I believe is pulling out all the stops. But it's not just him. They would all do the same thing. And whoever is elected is going, you can bet your bottom dollar, they're going to backdate this recession back to November or December because they don't want a recession starting on their watch. This is how the game is played. I'm sitting here poking a finger here at Bush, but no matter what president was in the office, they would all be doing the same thing. Clinton did some of these same things with the unemployment stats.
So you're telling me there's an entire governmental initiative to make the president look good, or at least the party look good.
To make the incumbent look as good as possible, especially late in the term. Now, the idea is they make the numbers look as bad as possible at the beginning of a term, so that things can improve later on in the term.
But
yes,
do you think
it happens all the time.
All right, so let me ask you this. So now you're saying that they're massaging these numbers to make them look better for all the reasons that you state. Therefore, would I be at least reasonably on track if I said, therefore, the numbers are a lot worse than we're really seeing?
Oh, absolutely, the numbers are worse. I'm
feeling better, though. I'm feeling better again. Things are good. I'm feeling much better now.
the way that we calculate unemployment, this is just compare the United States to Europe. In the United States, this actually happened under the Clinton administration. The people would lose a job. They would be roll off the rolls. They're no longer getting unemployment insurance. So once you expire all of your benefits, you kind of like roll off. You're no longer, even though you're unemployed, you're no longer getting benefits, but you're no longer counted as unemployed. You've rolled off the rolls. If you're have not looked for a job because you don't think there's a job there available for you, you've just given up all hope, you're not counted as unemployed either. There's a separate category. This comes out every month where they add up all of these other exclusions, where they say, another big one is people working part-time for economic reasons. In other words, they want to work full-time, but maybe all they can find is a part-time job at Walmart. There's a separate category for that. And if you add in all of these other categories that are excluded, unemployment is close to 10%. And that's the way they figure it in Europe. Yet the interesting thing is we'll have Treasury Secretary Snow come on and talk about the strength of the U.S. economy, how our unemployment is lower than the rest of the industrialized world. Well, it's lower because we figure it differently. And if we added up all the things that we exclude that everyone else includes, our unemployment is close to 10%.
So therefore, are we a laughing stock for the rest of the world? I mean, is it, you know, I've always been concerned. I've always taken all of this with a grain of salt, especially the latest numbers. It does seem to me that we are, at least from the Fed and the government, is trying their best to postpone something. And it seems like what they're doing is trying to make things look as good as possible, hoping that this will all blow over. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. They're hoping it'll blow over. But the problem is, by delaying things, they're only making the problems worse. What needs to happen is home prices actually need to fall. They rose 3 standard deviations above norm. That's a huge percentage base. Let's look at it in terms. In California, home prices doubled in 5 years. People acted as if, you know, that was normal. No, that wasn't normal. Now we've given back half of those gains, but homes were not affordable from the level they were at before they started blasting into the stratosphere. So all of those gains are going to be given up, and what's going to compound this problem is the number of home equity loans that were taken out on this to banks. We're seeing home equity loans are essentially unsecured loans right now because, as we talk, people that have a mortgage, especially those that have a mortgage and took a home equity line out on top of it, don't have any equity in their house at all. That's why we're seeing Countrywide Financial, Chase Manhattan, Citigroup, all the big banks are cutting back on the amount of home equity lines. Countrywide stopped them point blank, and the reason is there's no equity in homes for the people that want those loans.
Hmm. All right, listen, we're going to do. I want to take a quick break. When I get back, I want to talk to you about, here's a list I have written down. I've been scribbling crazily here. I want to talk about gold, commodities, oil, dividend raising, share buybacks, and what do you do for a portfolio if it sounds like you're extremely at least negative or possibly even on the verge of questioning the usefulness of any of this. So stick around. We're going to be right back with Mike Shedlock, who is a great economist, a portfolio manager, a money manager. He is also a professor at Minionville, and he is with Sitka Pacific Capital Management. You can get to his – what's the best place that give the people the URL for your blog?
Actually, it's very hard to remember, globaleconomicanalysis.blogspot.com. That is a mouthful. The easy way to find me is do a Google search or Yahoo search, whatever, for Mish, M-I-S-H. That'll take you straight to my blog, or you can find me on SitkaPacificCapitalManagement.com.
All right, and we'll put a link on our show notes for this as well as some other information. Stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there. I have an invitation for you. That's right. I invite you to join me at the 30th anniversary celebration at the Money Show San Francisco. It's happening in August on the 7th through the 10th, 2008, this summer, at the San Francisco Marriott. You're going to be able to hear from me and 50 other world-class experts in more than 150 free workshops, where you'll get every opportunity to refresh your perspective and prepare yourself for the uncertainty that may lie ahead. Meet face-to-face with 150-plus investment companies and evaluate the products and software designed to help you improve your market performance. Call 1-800-970-4355 and mention priority code number 011302 or visit the Money Show's San Francisco website to register free today. I look forward to seeing you there. All right, we are back with a fascinating discussion with Mike Shedlock. And as I said, look him up, Mish, M-I-S-H. Just check it out on Google and take you right to his unbelievable blog. One of the top blogs in the series. Matter of fact, I think I looked at your numbers. You're way up there, lots of subscribers. So obviously he's saying either something very controversial or something that's very right. So I'm going with the very right here because I know, and you know, folks, that I've been pretty negative on these markets. And I get a lot of mail saying, hey, you know, Andrew, what is your problem? Think happy and you will be happy. Kind of the Dale Carnegie theory. But I am questioning a lot of things these days, and I wonder what's going on, and Mish is keeping me just as unsettled as I was before we started this conversation. So, Mish, let's talk about something that really pisses people off, and that's the price of oil. I had that unique thing, which I think everybody did. I filled up my car, actually, and it's a SUV, and it cost me exactly $100 to fill up my car. And the first thing I did was call up my wife and say, oh, my God, this is expensive. Can you believe it? Kind of like every time I get to a plateau, a point where, you know, the cost is that much more, I make a call and say, oh, my God, it's $100. Oh, my God, it's $125. What is the story with gold, I mean, with oil? Why are prices, we'll get to gold in a second, why a price of oil at the 120, 130 range? And do we expect that this is really going to happen, or is there a chunk of speculation in here?
Actually, there's three factors going on. First off, there's peak oil. Saudi Arabia yesterday came out and said that they were actually going to cut production. They said they were going to hold their reserves in the ground, store as a store of wealth. And the best place to store oil actually is in the ground, because storage costs above the ground are actually quite expensive. So they are cutting back their oil production in spite of the fact that Bush flew over there and literally begged Saudi Arabia to turn on production to get gasoline prices down. And, of course, two reasons for that. One of them is political. Bush wants the gasoline prices to drop heading into the election so consumers feel a little bit better. That didn't happen. But an interesting thing has happened recently, and that is the consumption of gasoline, consumption of crude oil in the United States is down. It's dropped 4%. This is like the first time this has happened in decades. We're seeing decreasing demand in the United States. Yet, on the other hand, we're seeing prices soar to new all-time highs, $135 a barrel for oil. And
I think those two things aren't mutually exclusive. I think that the fact that gas is so expensive that people are obviously cutting back. It's not just because they're cutting back just because they're just saying, oh, well, we'll use less gas. I mean, I think there is something to do with the price that's causing that.
But is gas expensive? If gas seems expensive to people in the United States, have you seen gas prices in Europe?
Oh, I'm always there.
Gasoline prices in Canada?
Yep.
They're actually double what they are here. Gasoline prices in Saudi Arabia are actually higher than they are here. The United States, for an industrialized country, in spite of the weak dollar, has some of the lowest gasoline prices in the world. That's what U.S. consumers who have their eyes focused only on what they see, they're not looking at what the rest of the world is doing. In contrast, it's quite interesting. People in Europe, people in Great Britain, people in Japan, Australia, they know what's happening in the United States. People in the United States don't know or care what's happening in the rest of the world. That's going to have to change because the U.S. is no longer the driving economic force here. We've got a peak oil situation. Demand in India and China is rising. The U.S., for the first time, has to compete against the rest of the world for commodities.
But I don't understand how, if I agree that obviously it's been a lot more money for fuel in all of the countries. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you find a lot more fuel efficient and smaller cars, a lot of motorcycles, bicycles all over the world. And here we've been, you know, stupidly buying these ridiculous SUVs. I mean, I'm putting myself in that category as well. For a long time and really not ever expecting that we would have any problem. And I always say, you know, the biggest problem we're having is that there's no more dinosaurs dying. I mean, and you know, the fact is that oil is not going to be forever. But at the same time, I really do wonder, even though we can say that oil is, you know, or gas costs are unreasonably low here or comparatively low here, we've based our economy, and I want to say our individual economies, yours, Mish, mine, on a certain cost for our transportation. How do we just double that and expect that there isn't going to be a huge pain on the other side when it comes to all the other goods we're going to be purchasing in life?
There's going to be a huge pain. There's already a huge pain. We're seeing it in some of the suburbs in California right now. The people were commuting 2 hours to work, you know, and why did they do that? Because they needed to move outside of LA, outside of San Francisco, They wanted to buy a house that was more affordable. We are seeing entire subdivisions in California where every home is foreclosed. They're sitting there on the blocks. There are no takers. There are no bidders for these houses at auctions. And a lot of that has to do with gasoline prices. You know, people thought they could move out there and do better economically. They couldn't because gas prices to commute that much, especially with a husband and wife both working and mm-hmm. both commuting, we're talking thousands of dollars a month in commuting costs because of rising gasoline prices. So, yes, it has affected suburbia. It's going to continue to affect suburbia. California is headed for an enormous disaster, in my opinion.
So not the one that makes them fall off that the whole thing off of the from the earthquake and from the various fault lines that's going to fall off into the sea, but kind of more of a slow death economically.
A slow death economically. Mm. I believe that Florida is in a depression right now. I think Ohio and Michigan are in a depression right now. Yes, D is in depression. Mm. And I think California is heading there. And Florida, California, Ohio, and Michigan, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but that is a huge percentage population-wise of the United States.
I live in Florida.
Those five states.
I live here in Florida, and I live in the Fort Lauderdale area. And the other night, I went to a brand new, relatively new shopping center in Pembroke Pines. And I've never been there. My wife said, let's go. Let's check it out. We're going to have dinner with some friends. I said, sure. I was absolutely shocked at how busy this place was. I mean, shocked. First of all, there's probably about seven different restaurants or so. There was a ton of stores, from anywhere from these fashion stores like there's a Love Culture, which is a low-cost kind of a teenage girl type of clothing. And there's also Zumiez, and there's also, you name it. There's all the major. It was packed. I don't know how much. I didn't calculate how much people were buying. But first of all, everything's made in China. That's the first thing. I was checking out tags. Second of all, a lot of things were cheap in many of the stores. But how is it if Florida is in such dire straits? We got a place like that. It's just maybe an oasis in the western part of Fort Lauderdale or something?
Well, there are pockets. There are pockets of upscale activity. There are pockets where perhaps there's a bunch of stores there where there's no competition nearby. On the other hand, near me, I can point to just miles and miles of strip malls, and I look at some of the lots, and a particular one furniture store that just went in where I never see a car at all. I'm sitting there, and I see the grand opening sale, and I'm envisioning in my mind the grand opening foreclosure sale. Mm. Now, they may as well shut the door on home appliances before they even got started. And we're not, the area that I live in is not that depressed housing-wise economically compared to places in Florida and California. But I have people tell me on my responses to my blog where they're saying the same thing in Silicon Valley, where they're saying the same thing in places around Seattle. So there are these pockets. Austin, Texas, perhaps is another one, but they're few and far between. And even in places where Florida, I believe the state is in a depression, I can't account for that particular area that you just mentioned. But one other factor to consider is upscale tends to get hit last. This crisis started at the bottom first, and has risen to the middle and is now hitting the upper end. I don't know if you saw it the other day. Ed McMahon's house.
Oh yeah,
is
up for sale,
under foreclosure.
Yep,
we're seeing in the Hamptons, which is an extremely rich area, Long Island, New York. We're seeing unprecedented levels. Essentially, last year there were no distressed sales. This year there are $19 million properties that are about ready to be foreclosed upon, a huge difference. So, yeah, the cutbacks are starting to hit the high end, but there's always going to be a pocket of strength somewhere. And the thing is, all the way through this crisis, people would email me, "So Mish, you don't know what you're talking about. I live in blah, blah, blah. I live in Phoenix, and things are going gangbusters here." And I told those people in Phoenix, wait 6 months and then email me again. They never did. Phoenix is now one of the most economically depressed areas. Same thing in Las Vegas. Everyone has the tendency to say it's different here. And I say,
and different
let's
this time.
Wait and see.
And Mish, different this time, right? It's always different this time.
It's mm-hmm. different here. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's different here. And when it comes to real estate, it's different this time. When it comes to the stock market, when it comes to the dot-com bust, when it came to the housing bust, all the people that told me, Mish, everyone wants to buy a house in Florida. The demographics are overwhelming. People are moving from the Rust Belt down to Florida. There's actually reverse migration in Florida right now.
Mm-hmm.
Baby boomers are leaving Florida because of high hurricane insurance, high other insurance costs, no jobs, and they want to move back closer to their kids and their grandkids that are living in the Rust Belt. Reverse migration from Florida.
I'm dying to ask you something. I want to talk about food costs let me do this, and I want to talk about the market. So food costs. So, you know, I wrote a piece, about 6 months ago, and I've referenced it a few times on the show, and I talked about the whole incredible, the Pac-Man. I feel that China is like a, you know what Pac-Man is, right? So mm-hmm. you got a giant Pac-Man is what is represented by China, or Pac-Man represents China. And what it is just eating its way through everything in its path. You know, kind of it's eating its way through the Earth's mantle in terms of all the materials. It's eating in terms of every piece of food that's around and almost anything that you can imagine. It's absorbing because of the incredible amount of people there. All right, I think we know that, and at least somehow there's some truth there. And that's not limited only to China. We have India issues. We have issues around the world that are just as great in terms of the requirements to feed, clothe, and to take care of people. Food costs. You know, I did some kind of very silly calculations to kind of come up with what is the consumption in China, and the numbers are astronomical. I don't even know where you keep all this stuff.
The Pac-Man, that's a great theory. I like that. China, India, Brazil, the Pac-Man chewing up the dots, chewing up everything in its way. Yes, that's
one
of
the
factors affecting oil. We've seen rice shortages. A lot of the shortages, though, are artificial. We had Japan, even though prices were soaring to the moon, they have an economic policy to buy X number of tons of rice. It's sort of like the milk program here in the United States and cheese. We buy the surplus milk and cheese from the farmers. We store it until it goes bad and throw it away. They do the same thing in China. They buy rice well above the needs to feed the people of Japan. It's causing artificial shortages. Here in the United States, we've had corn prices soar. Why are corn prices soar? Because we're subsidizing ethanol production. So instead of raising corn to feed chickens and cattle and to make corn syrup, there's a drain on those, the corn production is now going in to make ethanol. Not only is it environmentally bad, it's at a cost that's not productive. The only way that we can afford to do this is because there's subsidies on the production of ethanol. Mm-hmm. Instead, Brazil has volunteered. Brazil wants to export ethanol to us. They can produce ethanol from sugarcane at a third or fourth the cost that we can produce it from corn. But we've got a tariff on the price of ethanol that's keeping gasoline prices here in the United States artificially high. Who's benefiting? The big grain companies, not the small farmers, and everyone else is paying through the nose at the pump for our bad ethanol prices policy. And that policy is as because of the drain from corn into ethanol, it's causing a price of beef, of chicken, poultry, turkey, across the board, prices on food to go up. That's the really sad thing about government distortions when they go in and make these subsidies. And oddly enough, they thought this was supposed to lower the price of oil. It did exactly the opposite. And not only did it raise the price of oil, it raised the price of food.
So with all of this, we've kind of covered a lot of areas. Not one piece of good news could we kind of get out of any of this. And as a money manager now, if I was to sit back and say, okay, I'm going to build a portfolio based on what we talked about today, because there wasn't a lot of bright light in any of that. Or if I ask you, Mish, you know what? How do you build a portfolio? As an average guy out there, what do you do when things are looking so lousy? What do you have, aside from cash, what do you have in your portfolio? What can you do to either combat this? You know, you're not going to tell me, if I ask you, you're not going to be one of these buy and hold guys that just buy something and hopes for the best over 10 years, are you?
Oh, absolutely not. I can offer a piece of advice to everyone. Before they consider investing, people need to make sure that they've got enough living expenses out there in case they lose their job. There's going to be massive job losses heading as we go forward. I'm expecting unemployment to soar, especially next year after the election. We're probably going to see some artificial distortion of the numbers between there, as we've talked, but people need to be prepared to lose their job. It's going to happen. And the best way to do that is to have a big cash cushion, to make sure you don't buy anything you don't need, to question all of your purchases. And, of course, if everyone does that, that's going to slow the economy down. But you know what? That's what's needed. Now, as for a small investor, I would just tell that person to not try and game the system, to wait it out, to sit in treasuries, to sit in T-bills. What we're doing at Sitka Pacific Capital Management, and we've talked about all of these bearish things, but when it comes to the market, what matters is what the market is doing, not what we think it ought to. And certainly, if you would have told me that Citigroup would have fallen in half, that AMBAC and MBIA, mortgage brokers, insurance companies, financials, banks across the board would be down 60% or more, that the stock market would have held up as well as it did, and that oil prices would be at $130, I would have said, you're not. But that's exactly what happened. So it's important to keep an eye on what the markets are actually doing. That's what we do at Sitka Pacific Capital Management. We saw reason last August that the market was going to head down. What was happening was four stocks, Google, Amazon.com, Research in Motion, and Apple, just a handful of stocks were driving the indices higher and higher. Meanwhile, the huge numbers of smaller stocks were getting hammered. That's one has to look at these breadth indicators like that. That's one of the things that we do. We said we don't like this market environment, so we went to a fully hedged environment. We stayed that way from August all the way until March, when we saw the opposite thing happening. Fewer stocks were leading the indices lower. There was a bounce. We played for that bounce and got it. But we're now back to being fully hedged. And that hedge position for us is we're one-third long, one-third short, one-third cash. We have a high cash position here now compared to a lot of companies. We're the reverse of hedge funds. Hedge funds take on leverage. When we don't like market environment, we take off exposure. If we don't think that there's a risk-reward scenario to the market, we cut our market risks, we raise cash, and right now that strategy I was talking about, third long and we're a third short, we're a third cash, and that's probably going to stay that way. A nice market-neutral exposure here where we're short the stuff that we think is going to go down and we're long plays like energy, where we see strength. But the average person might not be able to do that themselves. And for that person, I say, stay in cash. This is no environment to be playing around in.
Now, let me ask you, now, the market, give or take a point or two, is in the I don't know, the 12,000, let's just call it 12,500 on the Dow, just for the moment. And it seems to me that with all of the bad things that potentially are out there and all the things that have happened and all, and even with the financials being cut down by however much, it doesn't seem to me that it's very low for where it quote unquote should be. And considering all the things that are potentially bad with these markets, am I seeing things in a pessimistic, pessimistic light, or is
Well, you're seeing things as they are. I don't know whether one would call that optimistic or pessimistic. There seems to be an unrelenting bid, at least to certain portions of the market. Now, why that is, you know, it's hard to say. We can say we can look and say that yes, it's there and it's real. But if you've been in the wrong things, you've gotten killed. If you've been in the right things, energy, gold to a lesser extent, but actually both of them have done very well over the last few years, then you've done well. So this is going to be an environment where people are going to have to not only pick their sectors well, but pick the timing of those sectors. For the last 6 years, we've seen a market where you couldn't do wrong hardly in anything other than stuff perhaps related to housing. The foreign equities were up, junk bonds were up, corporate bonds were up, small caps, mid caps, large caps were all up. So you could have fired a shotgun 5-6 years ago and done reasonably well. I don't think that that same environment is going to hold true right now. I think the market risk is way higher than anyone thinks. People have got the idea now, and we've certainly seen it in the media, where eight banks, brokers, large banks have come out and said the worst of the credit crisis is now behind us.
Oh, that's such crap. I mean, I'm believing what you're saying. It's crap what they're saying.
Exactly. That is our opinion. But you know, as long as the market's holding up, you can't argue with it. But we saw the same thing though in spring of 2000, where you know the Nasdaq soared from 2,500 all the way up to over 5,000, and the bears were ridiculed all the way down, and the Dow crashed, or excuse me, the Nasdaq crashed from 5,000 all the way down to 1,500 on the index,
but it still wasn't. It still wasn't really. The pain really wasn't still felt until almost 2 years later, 2002. Remember how bad that year was?
Mm-hmm.
And it really was almost still a disbelief. And it's kind of like what's happening here. You know, people just didn't want to believe it because they just didn't want to. You know, they just feel the need to just stick around a little bit longer because you never know what's going to happen. But this is now officially the third time that we're seeing a bounce in this market. Right? We had it. We had some weird thing happen February of 2007 with that crash, the one-day crash of the markets in China and then kind of the spillover. But putting that aside, we really had a kind of a nothing happened until the summer of 2007. And then again in October, November or so, plus a little bit in 2007. Then again, we saw January through, let's say, March in 2008. But again, it's still not that much of a move down yet.
Well, I think the third time is going to be a charm and a negative charm, I guess you would say. The underlying fundamentals have never been worse. There's a lot of money out there, and some of that money is absolutely price insensitive. The average person, the difference between now and 2000 is the average person, .com, there were a lot of Silicon Valley jobs that were lost. Now we're seeing jobs lost across the country. We're seeing a wealth effect, a negative wealth effect, because the prices of homes are going down. We're seeing people trapped in their homes. They cannot sell their homes even if they want to because there are no buyers. All of this has so far only filtered into the financials. But when people have to stop buying things, and we're rapidly approaching that point, other than food, gasoline, and what they need to survive, and already we're seeing, actually Walmart was up today. I think you wanted to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing a downsizing of people that were buying at Target are now buying at Walmart. We're seeing people that were buying at Nordstrom's some of the other high-end shops right, are now buying on Target.
My Target, BJ's, and things like that. So we did see the numbers come out that seemed better with Target, and there was a discussion that said, you know, because, of course, speculation's just got to be rampant about everything. Everybody has an opinion. We know that. And they said that, well, you know, unfortunately, now what's happening is we're seeing the wonderful effect of the economic stimulus package, our checks being spent, and I don't understand how that makes any sense at all.
No,
and how it's longer term than just 1 month. I don't get it.
Well, it is 1 month. It's $600, and how far is that or per person? So $1,200 per household, and I guess a little bit more if you've got qualifying dependents of some kind. But let's call it a bargain and say it's $1,200. What is that $1,200 going to do to someone who just lost their job? What is that $1,200 going to do to someone who just lost their home? What is that $1,200 going to do to someone that's struggling month in and month out to make their mortgage payment?
Yeah, but the numbers at Walmart were great. Seriously.
The numbers at Walmart expected to be great. People are shopping at Walmart now instead of somewhere else. The numbers elsewhere are, you know, couldn't have. I didn't see the numbers, but I'm expecting those numbers elsewhere were not so great.
But how does it push the market 200 points, 75 points on just that one piece? Is it just that everybody's waiting for an excuse just to buy in?
It's hard to say, and I sometimes think it's actually pointless to discuss what the market does on any one day. One can look at various things. One can look at breadth. One can look at volume. One can look at the underlying bids. One can look at the fundamentals. None of those things are stacking up. So right now, it's we've got a bunch of people that believe the bottom is in, and that has supplied a bid. That's actually since March. That has provided a lift to this market. But a 30-year credit binge is not solved by a 15% decline in the market. Mm-hmm. And we declined actually about 15 or 20% from the top last autumn to the lows in January, February, March. Mm. Now we've rebounded off of that. I think this is a fake rebound. We're about to go back down. As long as it's going on, you know, you have to respect it, but that doesn't mean you have to buy into it.
And so let me ask you, Mish. Let me ask you this. So I know what I do, and you and I have a similar kind of discussion about much of this. But you know, I always scratch my head and say, okay, let me think of the other side. Let me think about. I'm wrong. I've been wrong before. I mean, listen, maybe you have. I'm sure you have.
But I've been wrong many times.
Yeah, maybe even more times I'm right. But here, let me ask you this. Where do you see your theory possibly being? Where's the chink in this? Where is it that you could say, okay, you know, I see all this. It's very clear. But this could be where my weakness is in my theory and how this whole thing that I'm talking about could be just blown up and really gone the other direction. Is there anything that really that you kind of keeps you awake at night thinking I could be wrong about this?
Well, from the point of view of how we're actually managing other people's money, which I would say very cautiously at Sitka Pacific, you know, we've actually done very well to be up. All three of our main strategies are up over 10%. One of them is up 13%. On the year. I think that's a very good performance when the market
Absolutely.
Is actually down on the year.
Yeah. Yep.
I think those are good performances.
Exceptional.
And we're just looking at this from, okay, what's strong? Try and be invested in what's strong. What's weak? Try and be short what's weak. And where we think risk is high, we just pull out of the market and sit in cash. So that type of strategy, I think, is going to continue to work forward. For someone that just says, "Man, I'm going to go out there and just short these indices, or short the market, or short Google based on valuation," yeah, I think Google's overvalued. I think Amazon's overvalued. But, you know, one thing that we learned, especially when the we saw the blow off in the NASDAQ, where it rose from 2,000 to 2,500 to 5,000 in a year, is a lot of bears were right. They were right 6 months too early and wiped out. Could the same thing happen again? I think to a certain extent it already did happen again. I'm still struggling trying to figure out how the banking index ever got as high as it did. It's now fallen in half. And a lot of bears didn't even profit by it because they were blown out by it. This is a very dangerous market, I think, for the average person to be in. And I don't know how else to say it, you know, other than that. Can I be wrong? I was sure wrong about oil. If you were looking for one place where I was wrong, I thought the recession that we are in. I sincerely believe we are in a recession, and in spite of the government manipulation of figures that suggests otherwise. But I expected the price of oil to not get above 100 and stay there for very long. Instead, it went to $135. Now, why is that? Well, we've got geopolitics is one. We've got, I think we've got a situation where there's actually less oil than Saudi Arabia, than people think is out there. The demand in China stayed a little bit stronger than what I thought. And there's a lot of speculation right now in oil, which is something that we haven't talked about yet. When you see the number of futures, the number of index funds that are buying into commodities, buying into oil, I think that's put an underlying bid behind oil. I don't want to call it a bubble, but let's say that it's certainly beyond the fundamentals, at least looking at things from the perspective of the United States.
Hmm. Well, we're going to have you back because we've run out of time here, and I do want to have you back soon. Will you do that for me?
Oh, I'd be once a week, twice a month, or whatever you're looking for.
Well, I've always enjoyed your conversations. I find it, of course, right now it's not the most uplifting thing, but I think it's probably the best that I could think of in terms of being level-headed. And when we get you back, we'll talk about some of the other issues that are shaping up in this very crazy economic environment. Again, thank you so much, Mike Shedlock, who better known as Mish, from Sitka Pacific Capital Management, an economist, writer, a very prolific writer on the economy. His blog is something that you really need to pay attention to and bookmark and put into your feeds, because it will give you all the information that you need. The analysis is, I think, forthright and not the lipstick on the pig that we see in most media. So thanks for joining us. I'll put the links on the on our website, on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll make sure that people can get to you. And I want to thank you for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
My pleasure, and look forward to being on here again.
Thanks so much. Same here. Coming up next, the Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt, talking about new issues and IPOs, things that may be of interest to you in the coming week in that market.
Hey, Andrew. Well, as you know, I was on vacation for most of last week, but it didn't keep me from checking in and keeping track of the market gyrations, and what a week it was. Honestly, from my perspective as a new issue investor, it was not a bad week to be gone, because the investment banking activity has been really very slow. There have been not many deals pricing, and I think we mentioned that and talked about how that could be a negative sign for the overall economy. So you can imagine my surprise Thursday when we had the overall market rallying over 200 points and, you know, people were all excited about the economy and things moving forward. And I was thinking to myself, wow, the new issues market completely missed this, because there's no liquidity in the market right now. People are having a hard time getting deals done, and yet the market's rallying. So something's not, you know, something just doesn't look right in this picture. So then we turn the page and we move on to Friday, and the unemployment report came out. And as you can see, the new issues market was actually correct in the sense that the liquidity had dried up. Now we're seeing that the overall market is much weaker than we thought, and things are moving much lower. And I think we're going to continue to see that. And the nice thing is that now that we've got a little bit of confirmation, it's a great time to brush up on our short opportunities. And the new issues market is a great place to look for these short ideas when the overall market is soft. In other words, when we're seeing the overall market trade down, the new issues market is going to trade down even more quickly. Stocks that have come public recently within the past couple years, usually those are great places to make 20, 30, 40, 50% on your money shorting these names as they move lower. So I may be a little bit of a trader here, but trader, it's kind of the same thing. You gotta play from both sides and make money both ways. All right, so one of the scenarios that we look at with new issues are many times these companies are undercapitalized and they're really dependent on liquidity to stay in business and to keep funding their business until they grow large enough to where cash flow actually pays for the investment that they have to make in their company. So one of those names that fits into this category is Clearwire Corporation, ticker symbol CLWR. This is an IPO from early 2007. They have been rolling out the WiMAX wireless internet technology in many major cities. The idea is that they put the infrastructure up and then people pay a service fee, a monthly subscription fee, to be able to use this WiMAX technology. And it's really exciting stuff. It's neat technology. But it's very costly for Clearwire to put up all the infrastructure. They've been having pretty aggressive plans as far as what cities they're going to build this out in. And most recently, they decided, hey, wait a second, we're not making as much money as we thought we were. We're actually having a hard time getting some of our markets profitable quickly. And so we're going to have to back off on our rate of growth. So they actually cut out some of the cities that they're going to be expanding into. And that's got investors' attention, and the market, the stock's starting to move down. Now, the thing that has me scared is that the company has a $2 billion funding gap, which means that for their growth plans, they need an additional $2 billion, not represented in their cash flow from earnings. They need to raise this money somewhere. And this is going to present a huge problem if the market is illiquid, which we've seen. Where are they going to get the money? If they go to the bond market, you know, there's basically no capital available to borrow. If they go to the equity market, well, then you're going to see the stock decline significantly as they dilute their current shareholders by offering more stock. So it's a no-win situation for them. Another dynamic that we see in the new issues market is that investors become less willing to take risk. And many of these new companies have pretty high multiples because investors bid up the shares expecting the company to grow extremely quickly over the near future. But in a difficult market, investors start to pull in the reins on their risk and they look for more stable long-term plays. These are not IPO companies. So recently issued IPOs don't fit into this category and they get thrown out. You can say it's the baby with the bathwater or whatever you want to call it, but basically investors get much less likely to want to hold on to their IPOs in a declining market. And so we got to look for some ideas that have high multiples that are likely to get dumped by investors. And New Oriental Education and Technology, ticker symbol EDU, fits that category. They were an IPO from late 2006, and they had a strong run. The company's making money. It's actually a company that teaches English to Chinese students during breaks in their formal education. So basically over summer break or Christmas break or whatever their equivalent is, this company teaches them English. Now, they've expanded into a new business where they're taking education, a more formal view on education. They're trying to get into the major schools, and this is opening them up to new competition. So while many are bullish on the name, I'm thinking that they're going head-to-head against other competition is going to cut their margins. It's going to make them a little bit... it's going to be a more difficult market environment. And then when you have the fact that the company is trading at a high multiple and that the overall economy is weakening and investors are less willing to put a higher premium on these growth companies, I think that you're going to see the stock drop maybe 15, maybe 30, maybe 40 or 50%. But the bottom line is I'm short the stock and I think it's a good short idea. All right, so for more ideas on new issue names, come visit me at zachstocks.com, ZACHstocks.com. Like I said, I've been on vacation, so there's going to be some new stuff up there this week, and I'm excited to let you guys know what I'm looking at from the short side. And Andrew, thanks for having me as always, and I look forward to next week. Talk to you later.
Hey, thanks, Zach. Thanks for that great report. Appreciate it, as always. As promised, I wanted to tell everybody that I'm going to give you an opportunity to help me, and I'll help you. How's that? seemed to work out really well last time when we were trying to get some reviews on Amazon. Here's what I want you to do if you want to take me up on this offer. Simply go to iTunes. I'll put the link to the book, the audio book for The Disciplined Investor in the show notes for this episode, or just go to iTunes and search for Andrew Horowitz or The Disciplined Investor. Go buy the audio book and put a review. Send it to me. I will send you a copy of The Disciplined Investor, all 248 pages, to your mailbox as a thank you for doing so. Listen to this quick preview. I think you may enjoy it.
Plan for the long term. However, they lack the tools and knowledge to make decisions on individual mutual funds and stocks. For these type of investors, a lesson in stock selection, along with an introduction to solid investment tools, will help them discover stocks appropriate to invest in. They should also plan to monitor their portfolio on an ongoing basis in order to compare relative performance. More likely than not, mutual funds will prove to be an appropriate choice as they could take some of the management responsibilities off of the investor's shoulders. Since you now have the lay of the land, it would be best to get right into why you picked up this book.
Okay, so if you could stand and listen to my voice for another minute, go over and pick up the book if you would like and leave a review. Send it to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com or any other way you know how to get to us, and I'll be happy to send you that book. Just do a review and pick up the book at iTunes. Thanks so much for that. And then finally, what else? Okay, so finally, the other thing is that if you do, in fact, want to be involved in the Disciplined Investor Growth Managed Growth Fund, make sure to do so. We are going to close down the indication of interest shortly, a couple of weeks at the most, and then we're going to open it up for the actual investment. So go over to the site, put your indication of interest, just to, you know, if you're interested, and we'll send you more information. We have a really cool slideshow, if you will, or a presentation that we're going to be sending out in the mid part of next week to everybody that sent in their indication of interest. So no obligation, just do so over at the Disciplined Investor. Thanks so much. Send me your information, any questions that you have, anything that you'd like to know, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And I hope you have a good week, a safe week. Be careful in the investing world right now. It's very, very rough out there. And I wish you well. I'll speak to you real soon on the next edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.